Buddy. First of all, I want to thank, excuse me, Fred McFarland. He's going to help here because I am technologically challenged and can't seem to figure out how this chat function works. And we've got 30 plus people on, and I think we're going to end up with 40 plus people joining the webinar. And so we're going to use the chat feature, and he will be our chat moderator. And then also Carol Panko is on. She's Director of State Services for the Blind in Minnesota. And you all would have seen the document that she prepared, her comments in response to the regulatory reform activity that is government-wide, but specifically the request that the Department of Education has put out relative to the WIOA regulations. And so Carol's going to be walking us through a couple of examples of the topics that she's identified. I'm going to give you some kind of brief overview of how the comment system works with the Department of Education. And then Carol's going to give you a few examples from her document. And then we're going to open it up for people to raise topics that they're contemplating, including in their submissions to the Department of Education, and see if other states have similar comments that they're going to make. And also we're going to see if people need help with how to frame their comments in a way that are most impactful. We'll try to help with that. So without taking too much time, the department is treating this very much the way they do a notice of proposed rulemaking, where they put out a draft set of regulations and solicit comments. And what happens is the department has a team that they put together to go through, and they literally read every comment and synthesize the comments and try to decide what kind of response they're going to get. What they're after are regulations that should either be repealed or replaced, and they're specifically interested in repealing or replacing aspects of the current regulations that they believe cause administrative burden or result in added cost. And so many of the topics that we're going to discuss would have those elements. One of the things that's very important when submitting comments, you want to have not only a clear description of the problem that you're seeing, but you want to... We're hearing somebody is on the... Anyway... you want to also have a proposed change. And it's okay to have those be tiered. So for example, just using as an example, the pre-employment transition services, one of the things that I have argued with the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee staff, and also staff from the Education, Labor, Education and the Workforce Committee. My view is that what they ought to do is anybody who falls within the age criterion under age 22, that any service that's provided, in my view, should be classified as a pre-ET service, including job placement. And my rationale for that is that for a 20-year-old who enters employment, that's really a job or career exploration activity. That rarely is that going to be a final occupation for that person. Now, will that be the revised definition? I doubt it seriously. And so I am submitting a comment that says that's what I think they ought to do, that simplifies all the administrative complications that arise from the new regulations. And then I'll go on to say, but if not this, then here are some of the things that should be considered for the regulations. So it's okay to have a tier of proposals as you submit your comments. Let me stop there, and I will turn it to Carol to talk about the work that she's done.
Well, thanks, Brad. So I'm really happy to be with you all to share what we've done here at State Services for the Blind in Minnesota. And I have to start by giving huge props to my terrifically talented staff, as this really was a collective effort in getting this together. Ever since WIOA went into effect, we've been keeping track of all the various issues that we've had, which really helped us in giving comment on this particular document. And my first suggestion to you all is really talk with staff and start getting your thoughts on paper. The draft is due by August 21st. And just so you know, the version you're looking at is version 6, and it is way different than where we started. As Fred had indicated, you definitely want kind of a flow to how you present the information, and it can be tiered. And the more complete you are in describing the problem and the solution, gives a much more concrete base for them to operate and to react to. I even had sent this draft off to my colleagues, and so I've gotten a lot of comments back, and especially about the Randolph Shepherd piece that I had mentioned. And we're actually going to do a version 7, so I'm going to remove that part, listening to my very wise colleagues. So we're actually going to remove that because we don't want to get that all gummed up in the works with what we're doing. But I think it's important to quickly get some things on paper, because it takes a little bit as you're really thinking through this. So since we've been living with these issues over the last couple of years with WIOA, I just have to tell you a little background on us as a state and how we've been operating. I've had kind of a regular mode that I've been working with RSA. I send off regular questions to them. I then follow up, and when I don't hear back, and I bug and I bug and I bug, and then I say I'd like a conference call. And then sometimes I will meet with them when I'm out in Washington, D.C. in person to chat about the issues as well, because I feel like if they don't hear from us, they don't really know that this is any kind of a big deal. And in fact, Ed Anthony had asked me, he goes, is this only your issue, or are other people having these issues too? Because they are not always hearing from folks. So I don't know what's going on with all of that, but I wanted to stress that is really important. So I want to talk first about the pre-ETS piece, and I started that on page 2 of my document. We have a lot of issues around pre-employment transition. And for a blind agency, it really has been, I think, the hardest part of implementing the new regulation. We have the 15% set aside, and in Minnesota, that means $1.3 million needs to be spent on 130 students per year.
Jeez.
And that's a ton of money. And it's actually one of the reasons that we ended up on order of selection back in 2015, because isolating these funds from our adult population put a huge strain on our budget. So when we looked at what we wanted to do to accomplish for our students and getting them into competitive integrated employment, right off the bat, we realized that RSA taking that position around tuition and fees, and that they could not be covered for students up to age 21, was crazy. About 50% of our students leave high school and they go on to higher ed. And we spend, for that group that's like 18 to 21, we spend about $350,000 per year. If I could include those costs against the pre-ETS reserve, we would not have a problem in meeting our obligation. And it directly relates to someone getting competitive integrated employment. So the comment that I make in this area, I actually had our chief legal counsel do an analysis, and he did this earlier in the spring, and I sent it off in March to Secretary DeVos saying, you know, I wanted the department to look at this. He did a very thorough analysis, and it really was prompted by Dr. Schroeder's thoughts on this area, and with getting the definition also expanded on the students age 14 to 21 to include post-secondary student. So we're like, this is ridiculous. So that's partly how we help to frame up that area on the tuition and fees. Secondly, for us, transportation has been a nightmare. Minnesota is really has a lot of land mass from bottom to top, and when you go from kind of corner to corner. And so we have a lot of problems with travel because we have so many students that maybe one person in one school district out in the hinterlands coming into getting some sort of programming. And there aren't always CRPs that can go pick them up. And so parents were asking for reimbursement and such, and talking to RSA and talking to them, and there's been really convoluted kind of solutions. We knew that that was an area for us that definitely needed to be dealt with. And so I speak to that piece. And then the third area that I talked about had to do with technology. And again, it's been the number one issue for our students, and especially our students that are heading to college. We've actually been contacted by our University of Minnesota, and they told me this 2 years ago. They said, quit sending us those blind kids that are not ready for school because they don't even know how to get onto the portal. They can't access their classwork and turn their things in electronically. And I'm like, well, okay, I'm not sure what I'm doing about it solely. So we got together with the Department of Education, and we realized technology skills are just critical to really leading for a person to have successful, competitive, integrated employment. And so we made our pitch in that particular area. And I have done a lot of work with RSA around this technology piece and trying to get them to at least now allow us to have a lending library. But it's ridiculous, and it's not a very viable solution for the long haul. So that's why I speak through that area. And finally, at the end of the pre-ed section, I put in what our solutions are, and you want to be concrete, like what's the thing you want them to allow? And I was laying in bed last night, and I thought, oh, for Pete's sake, I forgot number four, which was my first argument out of the whole gate, which Fred just talked about, is any of the VR services that are provided to a student age 14 to 21 to meet those particular 5 required and the 9 authorized should be allowable. So I'm actually going to amend and add a fourth solution that will speak to that, which is the reason you want to get your document kind of put together, and you got to think about it because stuff keeps coming to you. Then the other one I just wanted to talk briefly about is on page 10, I had talked about performance standards reporting requirements. And this issue had to deal with completing your IP within 90 days or that you have this mutually agreed upon extension. And I'm not sure if the rest of you have experienced this yet, but in our single audit that is done by our state auditors on behalf of the Fed, the last 2 years I have taken a finding in this area because we did not 100% ensure all IPs were completed within 90 days. And the first year that the auditors came out, they weren't even allowing the mutually agreed upon extension, as I'm showing them this in the actual, that this was in the regulation, that they're like, whoa, that doesn't matter. And so like, okay. And then something must have happened because in year two, then when they were just here, they were like, all right, you can have that, but they didn't allow for things that may come up, like we had completed the IP, we were waiting for it to come back, it had been sent, and we had done it well in advance of the 90 days, and the person hadn't returned it yet, or things that had to deal with, we have a number of students where their English is not their first language, they are new Americans, we have been doing considerable work with them, but their family's been on a different kind of a different time frame. And so they may not be as responsive. And so I actually had a meeting with RSA about this issue. I met with Ed Anthony and Carol Doback and Suzanne and crew and said, listen, my commissioner wants me to get off the dime on this area. And they said, well, you can never be in 100% compliance because people are people and we're dealing with humans. And so that's why I wanted to speak to that area. It may be minor, but for the amount of time we spend fooling around with this section, when if they would just allow a minor tweak so that you could have an exception if there's some sort of unforeseen circumstance that you would be able to, you'd be all right. You aren't going to get an audit finding in that particular area. So I guess the bottom line really is kind of talking and seeing what's getting in the way of you doing business. I bet if you talk to your staff and the folks, as you think about the complaints that have come up, those are really items that are ripe for comment. And like Fred said too, using any words like inefficient or burdensome really, I think, helps our case because this administration is very much about that in looking at this regulatory reform. So those are just a few of my thoughts, and I just will reiterate, I think you need to get started because the 21st is coming quick.
Perfect. Well, thank you, Carol. Yeah, there's so many parts, particularly when you look at pre-ets, and I think Carol's point about you want to make sure that you really give some examples. And one that pops into my mind is that you can provide pre-ets for somebody who's in college, but you can't provide the tuition. And one of the recurring themes that RSA keeps coming back with anything that's not approved as a pre-et service is they say, well, just provide it as a regular VR service. Well, if you're in an order of selection, that student may be on a waiting list, and so you may or may not be able to provide that service. But anyway, that's just an example. Does anybody have any questions for Carol? Anybody commenting, Fred?
No comments at this point, Fred.
Okay. So what are some of the topics that you all are thinking about commenting on?
Hi, this is Shannon McVoy from Michigan. One of the areas that we're really struggling with as far as the pre-et services go is the ability to pay for meals and lodging for students. We have a very rural state, and in order to bring our students together, we often have to travel, you know, several hours to bring them together. So lodging is a huge concern for us. So I know that's one that we would like to address.
Okay. And in terms of the solution that you're proposing would be just simply that it be permissible.
Correct. To take into consideration the fact that in order to run a program with multiple students, you know, we don't have the students in one geographic location to be able to run day programs. So for us to effectively be able to provide the pre-ed services, you know, we would definitely need to bring students together.
And Fred, this is Lisa Kieschel, also from Michigan. I also want to add to that and say that in order for us to serve potentially eligible students, that limits our ability to do that and on every level. And like our partners in Minnesota, we also have the hinterlands and, you know, rurally. But if we can't provide transportation, meals, and lodging as a potentially eligible, to a potentially eligible student, then they either have to go to VR or there's programming we can't provide them.
Okay. Anybody else? As long as we don't have people talking over one another, we can do it by voice or you can use the chat.
Fred, there's a question that came up on the chat.
All right.
Section 511 and staff have to sign all required docs instead of allowing for providers to do this when having to do presentations to 14C workers. Is there any way to get clarification and or maybe a waiver on some of those requirements?
Yeah, I mean, my best advice is when commenting on something like that, again, and I know we're having a discussion, so that's a little different, but, my view would be to frame what you think is the best resolution to the problem, or as we said earlier, you know, maybe there are choices that you think would be acceptable solutions to the problem, and include those in your comments back to RSA, so that you're saying here's the problem we're running into, and giving, as Carol talked about, giving a couple of examples of how it really plays out in real life, and then saying here would be the resolution that we would recommend. Thanks. Anyone else? One thing that is not asked for in the regulations, in the in the notice inviting comments back on these regulations. They don't ask you to comment on regulations that you like. Now, when with 511, it made me think there is a lot of pressure from the Ability One committee, or I shouldn't say not the committee, but Ability One providers, to broaden the definition of competitive integrated employment. And so, not saying that anybody needs to comment on that, but potentially that's something that if all they hear are people saying the current definition is too restrictive and needs to be broadened, and they don't hear anybody saying that the regulation as it's written is good or helpful, then potentially that might sway them to make some changes that you're not anticipating.
Fred?
Yes.
There's a comment from Jody in Maryland, and they would also like to see transportation be an allowable pre-ETS expense as well. So they will be reinforcing that.
Yeah, and again, I think making it practical, and especially when you're talking about kids who are potentially on SSI, and to say that if there's an activity but we can't get them to that activity, that effectively we're prohibiting them from participating. And as Lisa talked about, if you're in a rural area, that the only way these young people can participate in these activities is if you can get them there.
Fred, there's a question from Michelle James in West Virginia. In recent years, RSA has taken the position on regulations that if the regulation doesn't specifically say we can't do something, they tell us we can't do it. How could we address that issue because it doesn't pertain to a specific item?
I think that is a good general comment to make. Now, it would be good if you could think up a particular example of something that you thought made sense, and that you've been told that since it's not specifically allowed, that you can't do it. I have my own opinions about that. That's why I'm hesitating. But just parenthetically, I'll tell you, I've been doing a lot of international work, and there are cultural differences, and it makes me think of something I heard from a fellow who's chair of one of the international committees I've been working on, and he said that in France, unless a thing is expressly prohibited, it's permitted. But in Germany, unless it's expressly permitted, it's prohibited. And in Russia, even if it's expressly permitted, it's still prohibited. So there you go. Anyone else?
Yeah, question or a comment from Beth Lash. I've tried to participate via voice on the phone, but no one could hear me, and she did not have it on unmute. So she's logged into it online. Are there others that are experiencing this same issue?
Yeah, if you're not able to be heard, I think the chat function is going to be your best option. Any other topics that people are considering?
There's a note. Yes, California is saying the same thing.
Okay.
This is Shannon again. If you use the *6 function, that will unmute your phone.
Oh, that's very helpful.
There's another comment, Fred. In addition to items mentioned by other blindness agencies, I'd like to add to see the allowance of computers in addition to AT software, as this can be challenging for both potentially eligible and other clients.
And that's a good one. Now, it's a tricky one because particularly the people from the House Education and the Workforce Committee say that what they're afraid of is that all of the 15% pre-ETS money will get gobbled up with assistive technology or computer technology. And so they actually intended to limit that. But that doesn't mean that it has to be, it's not expressly limited in the statute. That may have been their intent, but it's not expressly limited. And again, I think making the argument that so many of the activities that people would engage in, something very simple like career exploration, well, these days people do that in large part through computers and through web searches and so on. And then certainly as far as the assistive technology aspect of it, that it be allowed to be a pre-ET service as an access issue. There's been a lot of discussion back and forth with RSA on assistive technology, where they have in some states kind of grudgingly said, well, okay, you can provide it as an accommodation, but you can't provide the training, which of course makes no sense whatsoever. So you can give a kid a piece of technology, but you're not allowed to teach them to use it. That's not expressly stated in the regulations, but if that's a problem that you've been experiencing with RSA, it would be something that you could ask that it be clarified in the regulation that assistive technology and the training to use that assistive technology should be expressly identified as an allowable pre-ETS.
Fred, there's an additional question. I'd like to see us address the pre-ETS issue of individuals in delayed status who are unable to access the services unless they apply to pre-ETS first and have a pre-ETS service implemented prior to their VR application.
Not quite sure I understand that question. Carol, does that ring a bell with you?
Yeah, I'm just reading it right now. So I suppose if they're on order of selection, so you're in kind of a funny situation. If you would be on order of selection, you'd want a student to get a service first, then they are allowed to get a service even though you're on order of selection prior to them actually making application. It's complicated.
Oh,
by the way,
I know what you're talking about. Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, with the potentially eligible people. So it does make it really complicated, because we have that same situation. I mean, because if a kid just comes in and applies, they could end up on our waiting list. We don't know what category they're going to end up in. They could very much end up on the waiting list. So instead, you'd rather have them kind of come in, get a service as potentially eligible, then they can still get a pre-ETS service, but they can't get any other kind of VR services till they actually have an application and get in, if that all made any sense.
So this is Beth from Maryland, and that was my question. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. And so, yeah, it really creates a lot of bureaucratic delays and barriers for people, because it sets us up in like a situation where we're doing two different applications. It's very confusing to parents and families why they would have to do two applications or two processes with us, two different types of plans. And the counselor, they don't understand why they need to come in and apply for VR after we've had them do the pre-ETS application. It delays getting them on the waiting list, which is unfair to them, because if they're you know, if they're trying to make the doors or the VR application, and we say, well, we have to do this first, it could be, you know, it could be a few months or more before they are in a situation where we can have them do the VR application. So there are a lot of bureaucratic barriers with that guidance that RSA is given.
See, that's a perfect point to write up.
Yeah, exactly. And so what would be the solution?
I think that they need to not look at, they took that position because they view, like, if they had given us guidance saying that we would permit, you know, you could do the delayed status, the waiting list, and then move on to implementation of a PRIET service from there, that was seen as somehow getting around the order of selection. Mm-hmm. And so if you can be clear that there are, I guess, two separate programs, and that it doesn't work around, it's not a workaround for order of selection.
Mm-hmm. Well, you could also ask for directly, you know, how job retention, you're able to work around order of selection because you're able to directly help people with job retention. You could ask for that same kind of, that there's a waiver for pre-ed from the order of selection, you know, so that those folks can come in. I've been thinking about that as well. I'm actually glad you brought that up.
That's a really good idea, and I think that the takeaway there is to show that there are already existing conditions under which somebody who needs a service doesn't can get that service irrespective of where they might fall on an order of selection.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank
you. Anyone else?
Fred, somebody just made a comment. It's access to computers as a pre-ed service should really be considered universal design, given that technology is moving in the direction. Under current guidance, this would not be allowed as a universal design technology.
I think that's a really good point. And again, I think that's a good conceptual basis for the rationale. And, you know, to use that as part of the explanation of the proposed solution, you know, starting first by describing the dysfunction, the problem that it's creating in actually administering services to this population, and then saying, here's how we think it should be conceptualized and reflected in the regulations.
This is Morgan Staines from California. Can you hear us there?
We can hear you.
Excellent. We were having a little trouble there also. I think we're pretty aligned with what's already been discussed about PRIET, and we appreciate the rich discussion of this topic. It will help us quite a bit. A different one that we've identified is the application of the OMB super circular pre-approval for purchase of equipment to VR activities where VR agencies have not been subject to this requirement in the past. And we have a concern that because of that history of how that developed, that the OMB activity, though, while not perhaps under the jurisdiction of Department of Education, obviously, but this is the place where we get to make our comment at this time, but that it didn't consider the various ways that VR services need to purchase equipment, including for our consumers. So that's one that we anticipate talking about, and we certainly welcome any thoughts about that from others. I've seen this in other agencies. You know, many other departments have been subject to rules like this, generally not for anything that goes directly to a beneficiary, but for some other things. So there's a question in my mind about how much to ask for in this area.
Yeah, well, again, I would ask for what you think is the solution. Back in 1994, when I was RSA commissioner, I eliminated the pre-approval for purchases. I think it's over $5,000 or something like that. And RSA has, as you say, has taken that away. And again, describing what the difficulties with that are, the bottleneck that it potentially creates in making purchases, and also, you know, if you've got, for example, a staff person that needs an accommodation, it it's illogical to have to go and ask prior approval to make that purchase when what you're doing is complying with ADA and 504 in making that accommodation for a staff person.
This is Carol. I just wanted to comment on this because I've been dealing with RSA on this prior approval right now. I've been in the throes of it and trying to get information from the different states. So it also does apply to like your state rehab council, any travel they may do if they have travel for their meetings. We have council members that travel a long way. We have four that come like over 5 hours, so they actually stay overnight because our meetings go till 8:30 at night. So the, all of that has to get approved. I've just sent in a request to see if they'll allow for kind of approval for the year. I don't know if that's going to fly or not. But they had mentioned things like if you also if you hire a staff from out of state and you would give them some sort of package to for relocation, say you give them $2,000 or something to relocate, you then have to get that prior approved. And as I've been talking with folks putting that in, I mean, some people have been still waiting 3 or 4 weeks for that prior approval to come back from RSA. So if you're trying to get a staff, you know, you might lose out because you're digging around waiting for that. So that's, I just wanted to add that piece.
Yep. Yep. The reason I waived it, by the way, was very personal. When I went to RSA, I came from New Mexico, and we were, this will be astonishing to all of you, but back then we were just then buying computers for all of our staff. And so we had a big investment that we were planning to make in computer technology. And we asked for prior approval and waited and waited and waited. And we were coming up to the end of the fiscal year and we had reserved all this money for this activity. And finally, I called the commissioner on like the 20th of September that year to get the, and she granted the approval on the phone. So anyway, you know, there definitely are bottlenecks that that would create. Any other topic areas? One of the things that I would encourage you, think as broadly as you can. Brainstorming sessions are good. For example, one that I know a lot of states have dealt with that's maybe not huge, but for example, RSA is taking the position that the state VR director has to be appointed by the governor to the SRC, even though the law says that the director is an ex officio member of the SRC. So I don't know if, you know, in some states getting the governor to make those appointments is a very difficult process. So, you know, pre-ets and some of the big things, obviously, you want to comment on, but any other dysfunctions that you're seeing as a result of some of the regulations or interpretations of the regulations certainly are fair game.
This is California again. We also identified a potential area of comment regarding in-kind match from our schools and other partners that we work with. It's burdensome on them and us to segregate it, and of course it limits potentially limits our ability to draw down federal funds.
Yep, absolutely, particularly in a state like California where you have a lot of third party match.
We have lots of it.
Yep. Anyone else or any other topics that haven't been raised that you're wondering if others are thinking about?
Fred, this is John in Maryland. How are you?
Doing well. Good to hear you.
Thanks. One of the items that has been a concern is the way that they've advised us, RSA has advised us to predict ahead of time whether or not we'll be able to use any or have left over any portion of the reserve fund for authorized activities. And that just seems to be such a convoluted approach that they've told us that we have to use, particularly, you know, that it relies on the needs assessment and demonstrating that that is applicable for 3 years out. I was wondering if anyone had concerns about that and maybe solutions that might be proposed for making it an easier process to know when we're able to use the reserve fund for authorized activities.
Anybody have comments or anybody else dealing with this?
Well, this is Carol. So we have been dealing with this. In the first year we did, our needs assessment committee of the council was going through our needs assessment. We were looking at the students. We have such a smaller group, it's really easy to do. We only have 130 to 141 kids is where we land. It's pretty consistently. And so we just looked at kind of where our previous spending lies as well. And what we do is we develop a blueprint. We have a blueprint that we lay out all the five authorized, and they're big. Their big issue is that they want to make sure you're providing that to everybody that wants it. Not every student has to have all five authorized, but you have to show that you can do it. Mm-hmm. So if you can show you're doing all of that, like we lay out what our plan is on that, we know what we're spending on kids for doing the five authorized, we then know how much we're spending on salary, and we leave all the rest open for what we can do under authorized, and then we lay out our plan for that, like how much each of these different areas is going to cost. I've sent that into them. They don't directly comment on it. I keep waiting for them to come back, but that's how we're doing it because, you know, having a complicated formula for 130 people is silly. So That's how we look at it. And we did it based on the needs assessment in the beginning, but then we do a tweak each year that we actually bring back to the council of our blueprint, the updated numbers and what we're looking at doing. And then we just have them review that and kind of give the thumbs up on that. That's how we're doing it.
This is Morgan Staines in California again. We're also thinking about the burden of the RSA 9/11 reporting, both the frequency and the volume.
Fred, this is Joe. One thing that we're looking at here in terms of this burden of impact of data collection and data recording. So first of all, we love the idea of 14 to 21 or 16 to 21, whatever services are necessary, all being allowed as part of the 15%. Where that is not going to, where that isn't supported, we're really going to be asking for a reduction on the demand for recording, for example, staff time. Instead of having, you know, 100% of the staff that are dedicated to that tracking time, we were looking for a simpler methodology that's less impactful on the time the staff have to do recording time and all of that. So, and we have a number of other areas along those lines that we're looking at in terms of data collection, so that we can, you know, back up from this layer and layer of collect every element of data known to mankind.
Yeah.
So Fred, this is Kathy Mowers Moore. It's so nice to hear your voice again from California. Additionally, around pre-ETS funding, particularly as it relates to third-party entities that are helping to provide the services, the burdensome nature of quantifying in group authorizations down to the individual student and the individual service that is provided for each student, much of that may become so burdensome that our third-party partners may choose not to work with us.
Yeah. Yep, and I think that'd be, yeah, that's a really good example to include. Anyone else? One topic that I'm interested in, I'm wondering if any of you are having trouble with it. So back in 2001, I issued a regulation that ended sheltered workshop placements as allowable employment outcomes. And we tried to do a pretty clean distinction about what constituted integration, because we were getting all kinds of what-if scenarios. And essentially we said that if it's an artificial setting, if it's a job that's created or that's available for the purpose of employing people with disabilities, that constituted segregation. And when you look at the regulations, it says all of that, but then it goes on with this, what I think is kind of a contradictory statement, where then it talks about having to go and look at the individual job and make a determination over whether it's integrated or not. And I'm not running an agency now, so I don't know whether that's something that's driving people in circles, but it just struck me, if you've got Ability One people saying, well, but in this contract, we contend that it's integrated, and you're having to go out and try to make some determination whether this particular activity is integrated or not, that seems to me like a nightmare. But I don't know if people are really struggling with that or not.
This is Beth from Maryland. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So I would say that would be an issue we're potentially going to struggle with if they change their viewpoint on Ability One contracts. I think that's definitely something that we're looking at. Would we need to deal with that? I would like to see if we could have some online, maybe group discussion, if possible, on facts around Ability One contracts. I've tried to do a lot of research and reading on their regulations, et cetera, to look at how, how that legislation matches up to the Opportunity Act, and just in trying to formulate a position on competitive integrated employment and the issue of Ability One contracts. And so I'd like a little bit of crowdsourcing if possible, in terms of if other people out there have knowledge, more knowledge and expertise than I do on Ability One contracts, I'd love to hear from people.
All right, and that's a good use of our NRLI list that we have. Other topic areas that people are contemplating making comments on? Any areas where people are thinking of commenting but are wrestling with what their proposed solution should be?
I don't know if you, Fred and folks, if you could hear me. This is Frank Coco from New York.
Yeah, Frank, we can hear you.
Yeah, I know today we've had, just with some situations, and I came on late, so you may have had some more discussion about the whole Section 511. But it's certainly it does push us into more very strong as the role of regulators in a lot of ways, the way it's constructed. And, you know, I guess because the law itself is so clear about this, it just seems like there's very little room to really comment on the regulation. So it does seem like, you know, we've been pushed into an area that is actually taking up a good deal of our resources as we try to meet the demands of that section. And maybe because New York State has, you know, literally thousands of people in, you know, these types of position. And then also all the, you know, when you add that to all the new requirements for the pre-employment transition services, and of course the whole partnership with Department of Labor one stops throughout the state, just seems like a lot of change at once. So that's all. I guess getting back to 511, it's hard to say, well, what do we say if the law is so prescriptive?
So, Frank, I've got a two-part response to that, and it starts by saying, still, I would raise the issue. Now, it isn't going to change the WIOA regulations. My guess is that the department will take the easy road and say, sorry, it's in the law, it's not regulatory, we can't change it. But I can tell you that the HELP Committee and the House Education and Workforce Committee are very interested in this process. And they're meeting with Department of Education, and I'm sure they will want to hear from the Department of Education about the comments that come in. And so getting that on the record, I still think would be valuable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, appreciate that.
Anyone else?
Fred, there's, and this is just a comment, that any information regarding Ability One would be a helpful.
Okay. Yeah, and that may be something that we want to use our list. Those, I can tell you politically, the Ability One providers have been very active on the Hill, and there was just a letter that went from, I think, 42 members of the House to the Department of Education. And what Ability One is saying is that their jobs are good, high-paying jobs, and that people are being denied those jobs because of state agencies refusing to recognize them as integrated. And it's a two-part thing. They're saying that it violates choice, and in my view it doesn't, but that's a whole technical discussion. But the other part of it is they're asserting, the Ability One providers are asserting that agencies are refusing to even advise people that these job opportunities are out there. So there's a lot of pressure, and I don't know what the department will do with it, but I know there's pressure. That this is one of the reasons why the department keeps falling back. Their answer to Ability One is to say, well, we haven't told people that Ability One contracts don't count. They have to make an individual determination. And that's what makes me think this whole idea of having to determine each individual contract and whether it's integrated or not could end up being a tail wagging the dog. All right, anyone else? Well, two last things. As you all have comments that you're at a point where you feel like you can share them, I think that other states would benefit from seeing the comments that you're planning to send in. It may give them ideas of things they had not considered. And also if, or solutions that they hadn't considered. So as soon as you're able to share those, I think that would be a very helpful thing. And the last thing that I have is a little commercial. Our next cohort of NRLI, we have four people from a state who just had to withdraw. So even though we're technically past the cutoff, we suddenly find ourselves with four open slots. So if you've got anybody in your agency that you think could benefit from the NRLI experience, we'd be glad to take them in. Anybody have any last comments? All right. Well, again, I want to thank Carol especially. The work that she and her people have done is just absolutely outstanding work, and I appreciate her being on and being a resource for us this afternoon.
No problem. Thanks, Fred.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
I think we're done.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.